This is tape two, side two of Bowen's interview, 7/15/87.
Bowen was working on what we'll call airborne radar for the British. So, again, I'll inject myself into this. As I saw it, here was in effect an answer to the maiden's prayer. If we could graft him onto the laboratory that had already been established at MIT, we'd pick up all the British know-how up to that time on airborne radar. And somehow, I have to say, I got him to show an interest in staying over here and working with the radiation lab. And that was made, and a formal arrangement was made. Now, in that Boston bag, they had the Oliphant magnetron. We had known what we wanted to do, but we didn't know how to do it. We didn't know how to develop a magnetron with sufficient power for the purpose. So here was the answer to our prayer. I was among the first handful, I guess less than that, who sat in on the meeting when this magnetron tube was divulged. It was divulged to Loomis, and I don't remember others, and to the Bell Laboratories. As a super, you might say, ultra-secret device. Now, that brings one to another step. We now saw what we ought to do, because here was the answer to it. The English, or the British, were bound that the only source should be in effect the Western Electric, but Bell Laboratories for the British magnetron. I did get myself into this. I personally had a very strong feeling that with the importance of this device, it was the savior in the microwave program for airborne radar. I didn't think it should be entrusted only to a big company. I knew a company here in Boston because I had done consulting for them. I did a thesis there in 1921. It was a very gifted individual, not a scientist, if you may put it that way, but a man who could make things and make them work. So I saw here an opportunity if we could get a big company and a small company for security, that is, manufacturing security. And I did become a lobbyist, not like Deaver, I hope, but I got Compton on my side, and we had another kind of a visiting member of the committee, Melville Eastham, who had built from the bottom up the General Radio Company.
Could you repeat the name, please?
What?
Could you please repeat the name?
Melville Eastham, E-A-S-T-H-A-M. He was the founder and the president of General Radio from the very year one back in, I believe, the 1980s or 90s, which became a blossoming company in Cambridge, manufacturing testing equipment. I got him on my side, and I like to believe I sold Compton. So we had a meeting of the microwave committee with the idea of letting a contract to Raytheon. It's in here. The top dog, a good friend, later became president of the Bell Laboratories, orated for 20 minutes with his eyes closed against the idea. Small company couldn't do it. This small company made the first 3-centimeter magnetrons that went into the service of the Battle of England. I won't get into detail on that because I don't want to take the space, but it was a manufacturing process that involved making the copper anodes out of layers of punched copper and silver soldering them together. It avoided using expensive machine tools for the job. They could pick people up off the street to run the punch presses and turn these things out with facility. Now, the Bell Labs was at the start still using expensive Swiss machine tools to take a copper anode and drill the cavities in it. And those cavities determined the frequency, and it was a terribly expensive job. But that was their approach to the problem, and here with the Raytheon was a very elementary approach. And right or wrong, it's like so many decisions one makes. If I had been mistaken, I'd have caught hell. But it turned out it was a saving grace. And that, by the way, is what transformed Raytheon into government business in the microwave, in the radar field, which they, a place they occupy today with reasonable éclat. Now, what happened when that magnetron got over here and we got, it was the center or focus of the subsequent work in the radiation lab, so-called, on radar. But it began with that Tizard mission, if one wants to put it that way. Now, Taffy Bowen went into the radiation lab and continued on with the work on airborne radar. Simple as that. I'm not arguing against the scientists over here, but it would have taken some time to stumble along and get to this point, had they not somebody right from the British lab working on microwave radar to graft or transplant. So, in my judgment, these were the critical things that happened in that very early day. Now, by the time the radiation lab got underway, there was really no need for what you call the microwave committee with a bunch of industrial people. And it gradually lost its effect. As I see, I mean, it sort of died a natural death. The microwave committee did continue. But by that time, the laboratory that some of us hoped for was under full swing. And we come now to an exciting point in history. Lawrence, on the West Coast, had developed the cyclotron, already built one big unit. Alfred Loomis, the chairman of the microwave committee, had been following that work, and like so many rich men, he enjoyed sitting on the boundaries and enjoying the spectacle. Now, I have to jump back to the formation of the radiation lab, the manning of it, not the establishment of it as a laboratory. And Loomis, Alfred Loomis I'm talking about, there was another Loomis in the radiation laboratory later. Loomis and Compton, I don't know who had the inspiration. Faced the problem of manning the radiation lab, now that we had the structure organizationally. So Compton or Alfred Loomis, one or the other, had the idea that the way to establish a laboratory, get able people, was to put Lawrence on the, Professor Lawrence on the microwave committee. And it was Lawrence who was the drawing card because of his great work on the cyclotron. Was able to bring physicists from all over the country to the radiation lab, to man the radiation lab. I don't know how that's in the books, but I think you'd find it if it was a deep study. And it was Lawrence, I would guess, who picked DuBridge to head the radiation lab. DuBridge had studied under him. DuBridge, by the way, was an ex-Washington University scientist, with due respect. But that's the way the lab got into being. Now, the paradox, and as Janet will know, I must get that word in somewhere, paradox. The nuclei of the radiation lab were all nuclear scientists. There was nothing for them to do at that time. So Robbie and a host of others were some of the initial members of the radiation lab. And later, when the nuclear question became with Oppenheimer and the laboratory out on the west, in the semi-west, came about, these men were all moved, I think almost every one of them, to Oppenheimer's lab to work on the bomb. Now, that, I believe, is the real vivid history, early history of the radiation lab.
Why was someone like Lawrence willing to give up his researches and come to the radiation laboratory?
He didn't come. He just served as a kind of an agency without portfolio. He was made a member of the committee.
I see.
So he didn't in any way alter his work on the cyclotron.
There was, after all, another nuclear physics group, though, wasn't there?
I beg your pardon?
There was another big nuclear physics group, though. Actually, that Bush knew very well. That would be the group at the Carnegie Institute of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. Did you come into contact with that group?
No, no. I had nothing to do with the nuclear worries at all.
I want to backtrack just a little bit. I'm interested in the microwave committee as it got going. You mentioned that you led a substantial number of contracts. What was the process by which you identified contractors to carry out the work you were interested in?
They were voted by the microwave committee. Up to the time that the power was transferred to the radiation lab. So the chronology is all of it here. one by one, and I am the one guilty of drawing up all these statements. The routine was to define what we wanted to have let in the way of contracts with the industry. And Alfred Loomis, as the chairman of the microwave committee, I signed them for him, most all but one. And he wasn't a man to be bothered by routine. And these things went to Bush for writing to the given industrial concern that was recommended and passing out authorizing the money transfer. But the microwave committee formulated the contracts, the substance, and that's all here.
And these would be discussed at the regular meetings of the committee?
By that time, we were meeting regularly.
Approximately with what frequency did the committee meet during this period, can you say?
I can't remember, but it was, my closest estimate would be monthly at least. So I was sashaying between MIT, where I had an office, and Washington during that period. And Loomis, the chairman, having plenty of money, I say that respectfully, there was a suite at the Riverbank Court Hotel in Washington, and I shared it with Loomis. So we had a lot of our rump sessions in that room, or suite, rather.
Did many of the contracts that were let go to corporations represented on the committee?
Most of them. Most. They're all named here. So it's a pretty complete Bible.
Was there any sort of a perceived sense of conflict of interest or anything of that nature at the time?
The committee knew, I mean, they voted for these things. There was no trouble, because the contracts were passed out pretty liberally. Now here's Bell Laboratories, here's General Electric, here's Sperry Gyroscope, and Westinghouse, RCA.
Would it be fair to say then there was a sense that everybody would get their fair share?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was kind of open for bidding. I don't mean by that we looked at the cost. We didn't flinch at the cost. Of course, the poor taxpayer paid it. I was one of them. And that those days, no questions were asked. It was to get results.
Certainly.
So I believe sincerely that this history is documented by my secretary in the Pentagon, everything is here, even the contract, the space at MIT. I spent a lot of time looking over the space and trying to decide what should be available for the initial operations of the microwave committee, and that's all here, plans and of the MIT.
What were the, at the time, what were the considerations about patent issues?
We went into that later. That's not a good answer, but it was, of course, uppermost. And Bush handled that as these contracts at start were all let by Bush's organization.
Which one was, you mean the Carnegie let these contracts?
I beg your pardon?
Which organization do you mean now? Which organization let the contracts?
The National Defense Research Committee, okay. And subsequently the OSRD, Office of Scientific, okay, Research and Development. Now, I suppose I've got to inject myself into this again and you'll may perhaps see why I was fired. But the day before I went down to see Mr. Stimson, we faced this problem on airborne radar. One, the Air Corps had to work through the Signal Corps. The Signal Corps was the agency to make a contract for the equipment for the airplane. Kind of a delicate situation, diplomatically and otherwise. We came to a point where the radiation lab had developed radar for airplanes good enough to see, I don't remember the distance, but say 2 miles from the top of the MIT building, looking toward the airport, Logan. We wanted the Signal Corps for the Air Force to make contracts for that equipment, which hadn't yet been, was all in prospect. It wasn't, the distance wasn't enough to make it practical as yet. But the hope and reasonable belief was that as they developed the radar in the radiation lab in sensitivity, they'd be able to do much better and ultimately have usable equipment. Now we encounter a typical obstacle in the government. The military rules, which I can't quote, but I know vaguely. Point one, they could make a contract of an experimental unit. I think it was 15. But they had to be able to get out military characteristics. And those characteristics had to describe the end result. We didn't have any end result as yet. So there we stood, you might say, in effect, anchored without being able to let a contract to meet the military characteristics, because we did not know how to set up what the military characteristics were at that time, because it was an experimental equipment. It wasn't proved equipment. And Janet, I don't know whether you have the few quick thing around, but Bush got out a paper, and the heading was Few Quick. And don't worry about it, we'll go through it anyway.
Does that heading have any special significance?
Yes. In other words, we were stopped by the fact that the Signal Corps couldn't let a contract, because we couldn't tell them, give them enough information to meet the requirements of the military, that you must be able to specify the military characteristics. All right. There was a conference in my own office at MIT. We had the Air Force, that is the Army Air Corps. We had the Signal Corps, represented by a General Johnny Gardner, I remember his name. And poor Johnny was string-halted. He couldn't do anything because we couldn't give him characteristics that would enable him to make a military contract, that is, one with military requirements met. And I must say, is that the one on Few Quick?
No, it's not. No.
I must say that it's one of these instances where somebody has to step in. And I turned to General Gardner, I said, what if NDRC paid the bill for the first 15 sets? Well, the poor fellow melted right away quick. So I go and say, then let's assume that we will pay for those first 15 models. And then, with a certain element of stupidity, I called Bush and told him what I had done. Now, this brings us to another important element. That was not only to have a laboratory to do the scientific investigation or research, but to have a laboratory that could make models to supplement the radiation laboratory's work. And it saved my skin to have Bush assent to the idea. Now that pulled us out of a terrific hurdle. That meant we had to establish a separate organization to make this equipment, make models. And I guess Bush, to save his own skin, at least he didn't bother mine, he quickly got out a piece of paper which Janet has somewhere here. She has a copy of it on the idea of few, quick. That was the title of the article. And so we set up a little manufacturing outfit. Melville Eastham, that man I mentioned of General Radio, was made head of it. And I like to believe that enabled us to cross a big hurdle. I don't believe you'll find anything on that in any other history of the radiation lab, because that happened in my office. And I think those are the high points. Now, as usual in these matters, there were so many people brought into the radiation lab whose abilities varied all over the scale, and out of it came some extraordinary minds. One of them was Louis Ridenour, R-I-D-E-N-H-O-U-R. It was Louis principally who fought the battle of developing the gun-laying radar. Now let's see the type name, I'm not sure of. Did you find it? Good. Now that's dressed up in a lot of words after the fact.
But let's get clear. This document entitled Few Quick,
I believe that's right,
establishes the this
freedom of
this
the
production facility for building the models.
A limited number. That was, in my judgment, a cardinal issue, because otherwise we were at a stumbling block.
I'm just curious. I mean, the military must have been very interested to have you establish such a facility. I mean, after all, the goal was a practical.
This General Gardner, who was in charge of this Signal Corps work at Wright Field, he was delighted. He was relieved of I shouldn't say responsibility. He was just a fine Army officer, matured Army officer, but he was helpless with the rules of the day.
Why don't we pause for just a second?
The date I'm referring to, a few quick, which has been produced here by Janet. The date at the end says Vannevar Bush, Washington, D.C., 5 November 1951. I'm a little bit confused because...
So am I. What's the date?
1951.
And it explicitly refers to the Korean War in the text here, so.
Yes, it's about Russia and Korea. Now it does, I just noticed, it points back. It says an example or two from the last war will show the need for independence, referring to the independence of the scientific establishment. There was then constructed a few-quick organization to aid in the transition from laboratory to use. It was built as an adjunct to the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which was itself independent of both the military organization and the whole gamut of civilian control centering in the War Production Board. It was a small effort, this few-quick affair, with little money or facilities, slipped in more or less furtively as part of development, which conveniently proved to be a rather broad term, for OSRD was not supposed to produce. In this sense, it's Bush reflecting upon.
It's what?
It is Bush reflecting back.
Yes.
On what happened during the war, but it is not itself a foundation, document of the war.
Foundation that's, document, right.
Right, that's what we just want to get clear. And there is a discussion of Loran and the ground-controlled
right.
approach
that is right.
which you played such a prominent
mm-hmm.
role in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to get, we wanted to get that straight.
So, at least we established a precedent. It's not the original document. I don't know that there was one, as a matter of fact. Some of this stuff has surfaced since the dim past.
Perhaps we should talk now about why you were fired from the Microwave Committee, as you put it. Since obviously it was rather successful. Unless you want to.
If that's a question, I will undertake to answer it.
Please.
Later, when you asked me to talk about MIT, I will be bringing in my relationship with Bush, which is long-standing, because when I had entered MIT in 1920, my first course, graduate subject, was with Bush. Bush liked me, at least I got pretty good grades. He liked me enough to want me to go into consulting engineering with him at that early date. There was a little gremlin that told me not to do it. When I joined the staff, I was one horse and one rabbit. I was taking graduate work and teaching at the same time. The head of the electrical engineering department, Professor Jackson, at that time, to whom I owe a great debt because my life with him, but it's great help when I went to serve Arnold later, because Jackson was, well, I remember his telling me that when I went in one day and I said, Professor Jackson, is Bush responsible or am I responsible? And like so many of these episodes, I knew I had said the wrong thing. Jackson says, Bowles, if it's a success, we're all responsible. If it's a failure, you're responsible. That was the life I lived under with Jackson, a man I respected. And he was really my surrogate father at MIT. And if it hadn't been for Jackson, I never would have been able to weather the opposition that developed in Bush later. We'll get into that when we talk about MIT, because I had to run an independent course. And by the time I got well along, Bush, in his arrogance, I would like to believe, poisoned Compton's mind against me. So when Compton came in as president, I didn't have a pleasant experience, but we'll get into that later. I had an encounter with Bush, finally, where I risked everything. Bush was appointed vice president and head of engineering, dean of engineering. Compton called me in on reasons I don't know, I can't give, told me about Bush's ascension to this throne in the organization. And like a stupid dolt, I said, I have nothing but respect for Bush's ability and not one damn bit of use for his methods. What did Compton do but go right in and tell Bush, who had just occupied the office, his office for the first time? Telephone jingled, Bush says, Bold, Dr. Compton has told me what you said. I can repeat it verbatim. He repeated it, and I said, no, Professor Bush, I said, not one damn bit of use for your methods. He wanted me to come in, tell him why, because he said, you know, he became not only noble, but he sort of had a religion. He said, I have to make good, and I'd like to have you tell me why you made that statement. I said, if you'll listen and not lose your temper, I'll tell you. There was not, I had nothing to gain. I mean, all they could do was throw me out. So we started in, and it was as if there was a little guardian angel sitting up here. My mind was clear. I could think of all the encounters and a little bit of his crooked work. It got him so stirred up, he called in his secretary and canceled all the appointments for the rest of the day, and I spent the whole afternoon in there. I came to the end where either he had to admit he had told a lie or else decided it was safer not to challenge me. And he didn't. I put it in the vernacular of the day, I had the goods on him, and he knew it. From then on, I got along pretty well with Bush. And that has little to do, although it's a poor way to express it, with his appointing me later to the Fog Committee, Signaling for Safety at Sea, and the Microwave Committee. This is my judgment. I can only give it to you as my judgment.
Can you roughly identify what year this meeting took place?
I can identify it, a janitor will get it for you, not right now, but it's in, I trace it because it happened within a day of Bush's appointment as vice president and dean of science, dean of engineering. That is reasonably early. But all I can say is that this gets over into the MIT relationship. Bush had poisoned Compton's mind, which didn't help me any. And after that episode, we got along well. He was a brilliant man, in my judgment, self-centered. Oh, thanks, dear. I guess I've got some water here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You can put that down. I'll drink it, and I'll drink this first. I suppose, with my animal instincts, from the year one at MIT, I followed this man like a dog. He aroused my suspicion at the very beginning for a trick he did, not with me, but with a fellow, a graduate student, beginning. And so I was acute in my ability to sense what he was up to, and I traced part of it, again, back to my experience in the woods with the lower animals. I'm never sure how low he was, but anyway.
What was it that Bush did that so disturbed you that you would grow to distrust him for so long?
I think the important statement is to say that at the very beginning of my life at MIT, I was alerted. There was a young man brought in to do work on a research, not as a teacher. In effect, about the same time I came in. There was a research put in the hands of the Institute from the National Electric Light Association, NELA, on insulation. They were worried about the insulation in paper cables and the breakdown of the insulation. He put this boy on the job, this young man, my age at the time. Bush came in one day with a patent application, asking the boy, I presume, to sign it. The boy saw, in his opinion, it was his own invention, connection with the cable research. The youngster flew into a rage, told Bush what he thought of him, and resigned. That was my first alert. Now, there are others. I won't waste the time to detail them, but it wasn't just one event. In other words, I came to feel distrustful about the man.
Is this what you refer to when you mentioned Bush's methods? Is that what you're referring to? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to develop it, but I'm ready to answer any questions if it's germane. So, he had poisoned Compton's mind with respect to me.
Could you expand on the reason why that happened? Why did Bush poison Compton's mind about you as an individual? Before you answer, let me go ahead and switch the tapes over here, okay?
Sure.